The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
All right, everyone. Again, because we want to move as quickly as possible to get through all of these panels that we have for you this afternoon, including the early assessment of the Obama administration panel, which will be our concluding one before the reception. Let me just say briefly, by way of introduction of the next panel, that, again, when we took our survey in January of areas that were of greatest concern to our survey respondents, largely members of the public interest community, of the openness and government community, records management ranked up there very, very highly. And when we sent that letter to the administration identifying those priority areas, records management was chief among them. That's in large measure why we have this panel this afternoon. And if you need any affirmation of that, I'm told, although I have not read it, that all you have to do is look at the lead editorial of the New York Times today with regard to presidential history. It is directly on point for what we're talking about here today. This is, in addition to FOIA Day, in addition to this year being the 20th anniversary of the Reporters Committee decision, that's going to be the subject of our program on April 28th. It's also the 20th anniversary of the litigation known as Armstrong versus Executive Office of the President. That was filed at that time by one of the most, if not the most, prolific FOIA requester of his time, Scott Armstrong, who, while he was a journalist with the Washington Post, had more than 2,000 FOIA requests pending. And he was the subject of some remarks by former Attorney General Edwin Meese that I could not repeat if I were speaking in a family newspaper. Let me put it that way, at least. And Scott will remember everything that we went through at that time. Scott is single-handedly responsible for holding the incoming Bush 41 administration's feet to the fire with respect to White House records. And sure enough, just as Senator Leahy and Tom Downey were speaking this morning, things tend to come around 35 years later with Watergate, and now we have the same sort of need. Well, in this respect, now 20 years later, there is the same concern about missing White House emails and the like. So Scott is going to bring that perspective. We also have a very valuable perspective being brought by Jason Barron. Jason Barron, as you can see in the bio part of your handouts, is someone who holds the advantage of having been both a trial attorney defending the government, or attempting to do so as best as possible, against the likes of Scott Armstrong in cases such as that, but now for the last several years, about a decade, I think, almost, 2000 to 2009, almost, probably seems like 20 years, right, Jason? Yes. Has been director of litigation at the National Archives and Records Administration and has become a leading, if not the leading, expert anywhere on e-records management. So what I'm going to do is sit here largely quietly, not so much as a moderator, hopefully not so much as a referee, and let these gentlemen discuss for you the important area of records management. And then, of course, if you want to start lining up for questions as we approach the end of the hour, and speaking of approach, that gentleman there will approach the table here with the name cards. Absolutely. Lest anyone not know, I guarantee you it will not be very long before you will figure out which is Scott and which is Jason. So with that, I'm going to throw it open to Jason to start us off.
Thanks very much, Dan. Let me say, lest there be any confusion here today, that I'm speaking personally, not officially, for the National Archives. The National Archives is sometimes accused of being like Switzerland on the subject of records management. And while I admire Roger Federer and many Swiss people, I'm not Swiss today. I have a definite point of view.
You might be Swiss cheese by the time we're done with you, Jason.
I hope not. Okay. And so here it is. I've been in government for 28 years. And every day for at least the last 20 years since the gentleman on my right, Mr. Armstrong, brought his lawsuit on the last afternoon of the Reagan administration, For 20 years, it's been like Groundhog Day, the movie, which is essentially that you wake up every morning and we're in this transitional era from paper to electronic, where the government 20 years ago, when Scott brought his lawsuit, the National Security Council was printing out its prof's emails to paper. Fast forward 20 years today, the government, largely all 300 reporting entities to the National Archives in terms of record schedule, is printing out its emails to paper. And my personal view is that that's either a travesty or near like it. The fact is that while we have been at this conference this morning and this afternoon, something on the order of 5 million emails have been sent or received by federal agency staff. And the question is, have they been properly managed? Are they going to be properly managed? Are they going to be preserved? Now, there are ironies and paradoxes in this area, because one thing that Scott Armstrong did, and Judge Ritchie, and the litigation, Armstrong versus Executive Office of the President, and the Clinton administration, through the good offices of John Podesta, was to put in an electronic records management system at the White House. And I must say, this is a case of no good deed going unpunished. The fact is that...
That's Podesta right there, as we
speak.
Yeah,
may well be. Yeah. The fact is that there have been waves of litigation, not just the current lawsuits brought by CRU and National Security Archive against EOP and the archivists, but going back to the Clinton years, where there were allegations of missing email then, and Judge Lamberth, in a case called Alexander versus FBI, held 57 days of hearings on missing email, ending up writing an opinion many years later, basically saying that no one was at fault for the missing email, but it took at least $10 or $20 million to restore missing email of the Clinton years. It has taken millions of dollars, apparently, to restore Bush 43 email in litigation that's currently ongoing. But the fact is that, ironically, and really, one really should admire this in terms of the irony of it, the White House, despite all of this litigation, is the only place in the federal government where email is reliably preserved. We have 32 million emails from the Clinton administration. I had to search 20 million presidential emails. The rest are under the Federal Records Act for OMB, USTR, and the other federal entities of the EOP. But I had to search 20 million presidential emails about 6 years ago for a case called U.S. versus Philip Morris, a RICO case involving tobacco and tobacco companies, which is still, I guess, ongoing. And the fact is that that search was only possible because the Clinton White House and then now to this day, at least are preserving email in electronic form at least at the White House. Whereas in the rest of the government, it really is more or less the same. Now, there is that from the lawsuit of 20 years ago. And while there are many reasons that one could trot forward as an apologist, I, for one, think that the time has come for the government to get with the program and to work out ways in which electronic record keeping makes sense. It makes sense for lots of reasons. One is that paper record keeping practices are essentially fraught with problems. We all, as the Achilles heel of record keeping is people. And the fact is that we all do not reliably, if we get 200 emails at our desktop every day, print all of those out if we're under a print-to-paper regime. Secondly, there is a world that has changed in the 20 years. One thing that is different is the web, Web 2.0 technologies, and a variety of electronic media where we now have things like unified message systems where voicemail is a WAV file at the desktop. You can't print out to paper a WAV file. And so any agency that's relying on a set of practices that, say, print out emails and attachments to paper, if the attachment can't be printed out, you already have a problem with government record keeping. And third is e-discovery. What has happened, especially over the last 3 years is that in December 2006, the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure were amended to include the term ESI, electronically stored information. And the rules were generally amended so that all lawyers understood that you can't just ask for documents anymore. You have to ask for electronic forms of evidence. And it encouraged lawyers to meet and confer and talk to each other about the ways in which records and documents and information and evidence would be put into play in a variety of lawsuits. The government is a litigant in e-discovery just like any private party, and government lawyers need to be aware that their obligations are increasingly such that they're being asked for the native forms of records in e-discovery litigation. So they need to know about metadata, and they need to know about what is the difference between the electronic form and the print-to-paper form of objects, and giving paper copies of records, of government records, is not going to be necessarily satisfactory. Now, I must say that you can win a lawsuit against the government without metadata. All you need is
Jason,
to...
Jason, I'm sorry to interrupt, but are you sure that everyone in the room even knows what metadata is?
It's the audit trail information. It's the cloud of stuff that in any electronic object, whether it's word processing, who drafted what when in terms of version control, or an email, all the header information, the sender and transmission information surrounds, the spreadsheets, formulas and spreadsheets, whatever is in the proprietary software that's behind where the user can look at is metadata. And what I was going to say, although you stepped on my line, which is that...
You know the metadata you didn't like?
Yes, that's right. You don't really need metadata to win a lawsuit against the government. The government's policies are good enough for the government to lose lawsuits. The fact of the matter is, though, that increasingly it is of importance. In some cases, if you're in a Title VII case and there's a retaliation claim, it may well be that you need to know who opened an email and when it was sent to prove up an element of the claim. And so for that reason, for the reason that print-to-paper policies are really a legacy of the 20th century, because there are new web objects, and because of compliance concern, because of e-discovery concerns, I believe that really a new day is dawn. And so I am happy to say, and we should make sure we cover it in this segment, that there is legislation, as evidenced in the New York Times article. Representative Waxman in the last Congress introduced something called the Electronic Message Preservation Act, which would require email to be preserved in electronic form within 4 years by government agencies, and require NARA to issue regulations within 18 months of passage. That passed the House last Congress, didn't pass the Senate, was not enacted. It's now been reintroduced by Congressman Towns as H.R. 1387, and the New York Times alluded to it today. I personally think it is the wave of the future, and that we need to think about electronic record keeping as the true e-government solution going forward in the 21st century.
Jason, it might be a solution in that sense, but it suddenly dawns on me, and perhaps in the minds of other people in the audience, have you just identified a way in which the total universe of records or information that may be subject to a FOIA request has expanded or will be expanding enormously?
I think there's no question. Ever since the electronic FOIA amendments of 1996, if anyone on the planet didn't understand that FOIA requests also involve searches of email and searches of electronic records, they should have gotten it by then.
But we're talking here about preservation.
Yes.
So you can't request what doesn't exist or what no longer exists. I'm just wondering, will this expand the universe of FOIA accessibility or hookability, if you will, simply due to the type of preservation you're talking about?
Well, de facto, it already has. I mean, the fact is that we live in a world of information inflation, accelerating exponentially. The growth between 20 million emails in the Clinton White House, to 200 million emails left behind by the Bush 43 White House, give or take a few that might be missing, and going on to President Obama's administration, where I've estimated that it might leave behind as much as a billion emails. That is an exponential curve that's true in every government agency, so that we have to make sure that we're dealing in both in the FOIA world as well as the parallel universe of the Federal Records Act, make sure that records are properly scheduled for whatever period of time, temporary or permanent objects. But to the extent that the entire world is expanding, there will be, of course, be more electronic records available for FOIA. It is, I must say, I travel in sort of Gulliver's travel world. I was at a W3C conference meeting, an eGov significant interest group, in the last few days.
Meaning what?
Essentially a W3C, World Wide Web 3C consortium group, and on eGov issues, and very well-meaning people talking about Twitter and Facebook. And I think that is certainly the future, and we should all be aware of ways that we collaborate in Web 2.0 technologies. But the business of government is still very much so mired in a world that is this transitional world where official record-keeping practices are paper, there's a slow progress towards electronic record-keeping, and it is vastly important for the FOIA enterprise to get the federal records side of the house done correctly in terms of making sure that whatever resources can be brought to bear for electronic government, electronic records management, that is a fundamental sort of building block of FOIA requests. If you have the email in electronic form, you have much more of it than you would ever have on a print-to-paper world.
Scott, how does that world sound to you?
Well, my metaphor for this is not too different from Jason's. In 92, I think, 1992, 4 years after we brought the first of these cases, I was up in Lake Placid, New York, with visiting a son who was on the Olympic bobsled team. And I'd gone up there with another son, and we had a long drive, and we were very tired. And I went to a movie with him that night in a small Lake Placid movie theater. And I kept falling asleep, and I kept waking up, and the same thing was happening in the movie. And I fell asleep through, and finally I said to one of the kids, this is the same thing happening again. And we were watching Groundhog Day. And I literally was sucked into it because I literally had to wake up five or six times and see the same thing happen. And I'm not sure, we wake me up soon, because this is this vision of where we are and where we've been has not changed very much. I want to correct the one thing that Dan said, Jason alluded to, which is my responsibility for all this. There's a continuum. There's a fellow named Eddie Becker, who was a researcher for us, who walked in one day and said, did I understand that the National Archives is about to destroy or allow the White House to destroy the emails from the PROF system that had gotten Oliver North and President Reagan so much difficulty? And I was flabbergasted and thought this was a mistake and did the right thing and called the White House counsel and got essentially stonewalled, went over the archives, got stonewalled again. But it's the National Security Archive that is an institution that carried it forward, and it continues on with crew litigation over waves and a variety of the rest of you, so I don't want to take any more responsibility other than I've been probably asleep the longest and woken up the most times to find out exactly where we were before. On the day that we filed our suit, as Jason will remember, I don't know if he was there that day, probably not, but we filed a TRO in federal court here, and the acting attorney general of the United States showed up to argue the case himself in court. It was a fellow named John Bolton, who became more infamous later for his sensibilities about good public policy, and he used a landlord-tenant analogy. I think he was trying to impress a judge that he thought might know more about landlord-tenant law than he did about constitutional law. He was wrong, but he said that the problem was that if they were required to keep everything, then the Bush administration wouldn't be able to take office, and he likened it to a landlord-tenant situation in which somebody was suggesting that the tenant would have to keep all, that the landlord would have to keep all of the furniture and the doors and windows, and that the new tenant wouldn't be able to come in. And the judge said, quite appropriately, it didn't occur to him that the solution was to take the furniture out in the lawn and burn it. But that's effectively what's happened. If there's no access to information, no meaningful intellectual control over information, then we are burning that information. And I would suggest that we've seen systemic and deliberate destruction of our access to government records. It is, can be shown in a variety of ways in parallel things other than just the management, electronic record management standards. I'm now making a fair amount of my living doing things that involve electronic, forensic electronic discovery, and the use of metadata, the use of things, and I know what can be done with it. I have a much improved, although not maybe as sophisticated as some, view of it, and what we've watched happen over time is the government moving backwards rather than forwards. We have databases. I mean, we're still faced with getting incomplete Vaughan indices that have no relevance to electronic records. We're still seeing that released information, the index to release information, is available only in limited form. I remember they getting CIA's complete index of everything they released, which they put in absolutely random order, and gave us one long printout. Things haven't changed very much. The electronic database of the CIA released materials that have been both declassified under mandatory declassification and released under FOIA is available only at the archives, and it's available when they haven't removed some information from it, since the CIA manages the material, not the archives. We could go on and on. I would suggest that the important areas here, we've watched electronic information disappear, not only is it destroyed on a regular basis, although there are agencies, I understand, that don't allow it, I see and hear again and again about use of private emails, use of things that, that disappear from the record-keeping system, not just in the normal course of events, but in irregular fashion. We have a variety of examples of lack of progress. There's still a widespread confusion. I quote, if you haven't read the Crewe report on this topic, it's worth, it's an admirable example of looking at it. The National Security Archive has produced others. But there's not a significant moving forward of the use of information. That's one of the things encouraging about Jason's comments in his career now, is he's trying to get people to be aware of the uses that can be made from electronic discovery. But we have a government that doesn't use its information effectively. And the consequences of that are catastrophic. They don't make it accessible to you, so you can't use it successfully. But if you look back, and if we'd had meaningful oversight over time, if we had something other than this recalcitrant attitude, and I hold a variety of institutions responsible for this, not just the archives or the Department of Justice or the White House, but the courts and Congress have been contributing factors to this. But if you look at what information has been withdrawn and you look at the consequences of what that can be, and you go back and do a forensic study of some of these recent developments in our economic system, you look at the records that are not available, that were available to the government and should have been electronically available, in every instance of a major economic institution failing, including the Comptroller of the Currency records, including custodial records that should otherwise be published, including SEC records, including State Department records that should have been systemically released by now, you'll see that there was enough information available for people to have documented and perceived many, if not most, of these what are now clearly economic tragedies that are being spread across the country. It is as if instead of going from electronic information back to paper. We were really going back and putting things, my metaphor for it would be to put microfilm back in the pumpkin patch. It's maybe the only metaphor that that Mr. Weinstein could have appreciated. I'm sorry that he's not able to be with us, because I'd love to beat him up a bit more. I'm sorry for his trouble. But
he's not kidding.
I know. But the National Archives has made virtually no contribution to this. That's the number of starts and stops that have begun about getting control over intellectual control, management record control over government records is phenomenal. It's a huge problem, admittedly. The Department of Defense has suggested a standard, but the notion that someone has not accepted this as a challenge and enforced a national conversation, insofar as it can be had nationally, but among sophisticated parties, on this topic, such that we would be moving toward now the implementation of legislation that would be even more sweeping than what has been pending. Flabbergasted me. We're talking about putting together a national health system records, national health record system that will be both available to for patient and doctor use, will be available for insurance use, will be available for audits, and will still respect HIPAA. And if that's even remotely approachable, which I think it is, as I've worked a little bit with health records more recently, it is approachable, then we certainly ought to be able to handle and create a national standard and make electronic records accessible. It is easier to preserve the record in many instances than it is to fish out from the maw that of record keeping that Jason describes, that which is relevant. And so we may be stuck with a situation where for some period of time we're going to continue to hold the maw and have to deal with it further down the line. The solution to that is like the solution to the classification problem. The solution to the classification problem is not declassification of materials that don't need to be classified. It's using appropriate means to not classify them in the first place, or to portion mark them in such a way, using the terror line, the hierarchical approach to classified information, so that at the front end, you don't create this something that you need to then reach into and selectively declassify. It requires a new approach. It requires a new beginning. Somebody has to declare that this is the time we're going to do it. If there's ever an administration that has an opportunity to do it, because this is money that could be well spread around the country doing dealing with the information infrastructure, this is the time and the place to do it. So let me pause there, and hopefully we'll come up with some of these other things in the form of answers to questions, or maybe we'll end up questioning each other.
Jason might or might not agree completely with what you said. I don't
well,
know.
Well, let me repeat. I am not an apologist for anyone. I do think that the National Archives has, for the last decade or so, supported something called a DOD 5015.2 standard for electronic record-keeping products. That is, that the Department of Defense basically tests electronic software to see whether or not it meets a certain set of specifications and can be used as the electronic record-keeping system, the document management system for federal agencies. So there's a pick list. You can go to a website that's run by DOD. You can go down a pick list if you're an agency person and see the various products, the software that's there, that are all both compliant with that standard as well as endorsed by the National Archives. The problem with that is that the marketplace has essentially voted, and from my observations, and it's not a scientific survey, but my anecdotal evidence is such that agencies are not running to use the 5015.2 products, although they are somewhere, someplace in government used, and there are some success stories. But in fact, what has there is a problem with it, which is that there's a lot of front-end work has to be done to the software. It's not universally applicable to the federal environment. That's an issue. Second, it is this Achilles heel problem that I mentioned, the same issue that for all of us, why we don't print out our emails reliably to paper. We also don't drag and drop emails and other forms of objects to these kind of 5.0 and 5.2 systems, because it's a little bit of like a Rube Goldberg scheme. You have to set up a whole set of boxes and make sure that you can drag and drop. And if you only have one or two keystrokes, maybe you can do it. But even so, it's not reliable. The problem is the end user. And so there is a movement that I have seen, and the National Archives has recognized in a bulletin that was issued last year on email archiving, there is some places in government, there are some places that are recognizing the need to take a snapshot of all email because of the litigation risk, because of e-discovery risk, because of congressmen who want to question where is email from 6 years ago, basically taking a snapshot of everything and putting it in a holding area or a big bucket. The problem with that is that, of course, when you have a haystack that's a billion objects, it's very difficult to find the needle. Very difficult to find the particular email that you want. There are a variety of search techniques that are out there, but the Sedona Conference that I'm a representative to from the National Archives has put out a commentary on essentially the limitations of keyword searching, limitations of search techniques, and so we're not quite there when we save everything approach, isn't quite there if we're also saving a lot of junk, a lot of the fantasy football comments that might weave themselves in, as well as substantive government communications. Now, if you can do a filter on the front end to take out the ephemeral, the transitory, the spam, the RSS feeds, the stuff which really doesn't count, and if you can somehow do smart filters on the back end of these large repositories in terms of using artificial intelligence and ways to extract out the wheat from the chaff, it may well be that electronic archiving works as a solution for the future. I'm personally supportive of it because it takes away the problem, which has been a problem for the 20 years that been involved since Scott filed his lawsuit, which is that we are all record keepers in government. We're all expected. We no longer have secretaries. We're all expected to do our own record keeping as individuals. And that is not what people wake up in the morning as the mission of why they're coming to work is to do good record keeping. They do whatever it is that their agency is about in terms of the mission of the agency and should be applauded for that. But record keeping is important as a secondary function. And so any ways to automate or to make more transparent to the user a record keeping paradigm would be well received. And so I'm very supportive of technologies that are out there that go beyond the 5.0 and 5.2 standard, but to something where it's a true capture of all objects in the electronic environment.
Jason,
I just want to make sure I understand the two surprises here. One surprise is that the human endeavor of governing is susceptible to human failure. That's surprise number one. I think I got that a long time ago. And then the second one is that if you don't lead and tell people what to do, they won't do what they need to do. But isn't the solution to that leading and telling them what to do? And isn't that require mandates? And doesn't that require the creation of something that people are obligated to do across agencies? And doesn't that get around some of the difficulty of agency budgets that they're reluctant to buy proprietary things? Because I think the standard may change. They have a lot of front-end work. They have to have consultants and contracts. Isn't government in the business of doing that at a scale that is larger than the scale of any customary business? Isn't it in the government's interest to set that business up and do it and execute it?
Well, I personally would agree, and I think that the step in the right direction, it may well be that that the National Archives should be in front of the legislation which is now being proposed in Congress. But the legislation sets a four-year mandate, as I understand it. If it were to be enacted today, within 4 years, there would be a requirement for across the government to preserve electronic mail and other forms of electronic records that are compatible with the legislation in electronic form. Now that, from where we are today, even though there's a lot of water under the bridge and there should have been a lot of efforts between 1989 and now, where we are today, that still seems to me to be a mountain to climb because I still think it's to some extent an unfunded mandate of Congress. I'm not sure that the appropriations are being put into place to buy whatever systems that are needed. For that. If there was a way for the government to assert itself in the marketplace to maybe simplify the kind of products that are available to us, that's certainly something that I think should be considered. But I do see the legislation as a hopeful sign that we can get past this kind of legacy era of print to paper, where the default is that electronic objects really do stay in electronic form for whatever their lifespan, whether it's a temporary record of 10 years, 20 years, 50 years, or permanent records that come to the National Archives.
Is the DOD 51, whatever,
yeah,
5100,
50, whatever, 15.2, yeah.
Is that a sufficient starting point for a universal format?
One would have thought so 10 years ago, but I must say that I confess that as I said, the marketplace has voted. Not many agencies have deployed these kind of electronic record keeping products, and I think to a large extent because they need to be customized and a lot of work on the front end, where individuals in the IT community don't perceive that they have the budgetary resources to do a full-scale, scalable-up deployment to an agency-wide or a cabinet-wide effort. I do know that there are certain places in government where it has worked. So, yes, it may be a first step. I think it will be overtaken by the mandate of this legislation, assuming that it's enacted, that they're going to have some serious thinking, both at the National Archives, if we're mandated to do regs in within 18 months, as well as the four-year requirement. Now, having said that, the last I checked, the National Archives doesn't have a police force. So the fact is that while there may be a four-year mandate, it's certainly incumbent on us to do whatever kind of oversight and inspection that we have within our budgetary resources, but we don't have enough people to look at every agency's implementation of such a requirement. And so it's going to be really incumbent on the heads of agencies, which by statute, by the Federal Records Act, they are responsible for records management. They should, if that legislation comes down and it's enacted, take up the cudgel and move forward within the 4 years to see whether they can actually move towards e-government.
So in the government red light district, this metaphor is going to help me a lot, I think. In the government red light district, where there's no sheriff, we're not surprised that the whores are still on the street and that the Johns are still patronizing them rather than mandating the purchase of getting together to have a police department. Isn't that the antithesis of government? I mean, isn't there something seriously wrong here? Has the National Archives taken some position I've missed, saying that this is a must, that this must be solved, just look at the government governing by the use of information alone should be a mandate enough for this. But the fact that citizens are continually blocked out indefinitely by the locking of this information away, effective locking it away, until we discover it in the pumpkin patch and pull out the microfiche, we don't get it. So now that I've mixed all these metaphors together and accused you of prostitution or pimping or something, isn't there somebody that's going to rise to the occasion and suggest that this is a mandate that the executive branch must take on?
I personally agree with you, and I have spent on dozens of occasions, I agree with you to this extent, colorful metaphors aside, more can be done to impress upon federal government at large the upside of doing electronic record keeping. But everywhere I go, I meet resistance. Hopefully that the archives, whether it's mandated by the a new form of EMPA, the Electronic Message Preservation Act, or by a new archivist, putting as a priority to state some general principles, or with the help of President Obama and his administration. I think some mandate from on high, from OMB, from various offices of the White House would be very helpful in this area to get the message out to federal agencies. I don't think the archives can do it alone. I think reasonable people can disagree as to the authority that we've had over these years to basically throw down the mandate, as you suggest. But I personally am supportive of all of these efforts that we've talked about.
We're still talking about a victimless crime, and it's not a victimless crime. It's like my prostitution metaphor. There's AIDS among us. That's the impact that this loose approach to information management has had in one administration after another, the inability to enforce other laws, the inability to scrutinize agencies. It's not so much a question of who's going to regulate the financial markets as whether or not anybody regulates them when, in fact, the data is as faulty and as flawed and inaccessible as it presently is.
Scott, let me put the question to you that's basically raised by the last thing that Jason said. You've been speaking about Congress and about how whether it acts or not, and then the effect of a congressional enactment. You've been speaking about the archivist's inability to make something stick because he carries no stick. Scott, do you think that the best solution right now would be, as Jason suggests, a clear mandate from the White House, from the Obama administration, that would try to get the executive branch in line? Or do you think we lost the ability to regulate the horse during the Clinton administration?
I think my metaphor did get one of us in trouble.
Yeah, there you go.
I'm not sure which.
No, seriously, is it time for the White House to finally try to break the logjam here and issue an executive order or a presidential directive that in effect says, listen, agencies, you haven't been doing things right up until now, and even when Congress acts, you don't necessarily follow that, let alone what the archives directs. Now it's time for you to be commanded to do the right thing, not the wrong thing, with respect to records management. Is that something that you should be pushing for?
Yes, and we have some people who at least have staffed this White House that have been that are sophisticated, knowledgeable people, and I think there's an ability to marshal an articulate presentation of it for a lot of very good reasons that are economically will give it a viability, such as healthcare information and so forth. But it also has to occur in the world of controlled information, that if you continue to control so much in such a random and haphazard way and not enforce the law, which is already on the books, about the prioritizing of information such that we have a tear line, which is uniformly ignored. I think it's the exception when it's observed rather than the rule. Those two areas, the way in which information is going to be controlled and the fact that when it's maintained and preserved, it must be maintained and preserved in an accessible way, should be a presidential mandate, and it should happen soon.
Has there been a call for that explicitly in the past, do you know? Or would this be the first time that that was explicitly, expressly asked for by the public interest community?
I think we've been asking for lots of things, decent, good public policy, not the least of them. But I don't think we've asked as simply, and I don't think we've had the argument before that we have now, which is the consequences of not having this. As I say, the needs of a national healthcare information system are not that dissimilar. And there comes a time when government must step in and stop this rush to proprietary solutions and mandate that a solution, there can be a debate, there can be participation, there can be proprietary propositions put forward, but eventually the government must adopt something, must adopt it in a universal and accessible form, and ignore the fact that the marketplace of the literal marketplace is impeding the progress of the government marketplace.
If there were to be a broad coalition supporting that, and this is my final question along this line, a broad coalition supporting that, advocating that in a forceful way as never before, is it the type of thing that there are other vested interests that might oppose it? Or is it really the type of thing that is such a good idea that no one sensibly could stand in opposition to it?
Well, apparently the National Archives has a vested interest. It hasn't been for it over time. I mean, they've been for it in a mythical sense. But no, to be less facetious about it, there are obviously external forces. There are the same people that oppose the National Health Information Plan, the health insurance companies, and certain aspects of the healthcare industry are going to be unhappy about unhappy about this. The defense contracting community, I mentioned, they enjoy these compartments they enjoy the special access programs that make their programs effectively unauditable by any sensible auditor or auditor who's not already compromised and so forth. So I would expect it to be very organized and articulate resistance, but I don't think we've ever had a time when we could make a more articulate argument for it that economic terms alone begin to call for it. That insofar as it does have an expense, it's an expense that can be spread equitably. There's an educational component to it that would drive some new industries and some educational product. So I think that it has the elements of a coalition. I haven't been in Washington, so I haven't been participating as I should have in this process, but I think now's the time to begin to I don't want to patronize. I think a lot of people have given some thought to it, but I think now's the time for us to get behind them to help them do it.
How does that strike you unofficially, Jason?
My personal views is that I support all such efforts. I must say there is another actor in the overall universe, which is, I'm a trial lawyer. I understand the pressure points that litigation brings to bear. Not that I'm encouraging more lawsuits against the archives or against the government, but the fact is that the e-discovery world, lawyers have woken up, as I mentioned in my opening remarks. And as a driver of cultural change, there is nothing like a very painful lawsuit. The D.C. Circuit, in a recent case called In re Fannie Mae litigation, upheld a contempt finding against the office that runs Fannie Mae for failing to live up to stipulated deadlines, even though they spent 9% of their budget doing searches of backup tapes to find what ultimately were 660,000 documents of relevance to the litigation. That agency should get it now. The Department of Interior should get it after a decade of litigation in Cobell. There are litigation that driven aspects where this kind of black swan event, where a catastrophe in terms of litigation facing an agency in terms of their own budget, diverting resources is really a wake-up call for the agency. And so I think, in addition to the good efforts, public interest community to push the agenda, to have electronic record keeping, to have a true e-government, to urge the administration give more serious thought to it in all sorts of ways, I do think that the marketplace will vote as well, and that we will see over a continuing set of cases in the e-discovery area driving agencies to think twice about their existing record-keeping policies.
Interesting. Well, let's throw it out for questions at this point, and I'll just start it off, or perhaps not, given how many people have. No, I withdraw the question. We want to make sure we can accommodate everyone who's interested, so we'll start with this gentleman very quickly right here.
Sure. Thank you both for coming to WCL today. I'm a student here. I'm also writing about these issues for the Law Review. I was wondering, Mr. Barron, you brought up the EMPA a little earlier and that it was reintroduced this week. It didn't only die in the Senate, it also encountered a veto threat from the Bush administration. I was wondering if I could gather your thoughts on whether you foresee that those kind of threats, balance of power threats, that the bill would be unconstitutionally giving the archivist more control, would it still be present in the new era with the Obama administration?
The true answer is that the answer from the administration is above my pay grade to give, so I can't say what the administration will say officially about the bill if it includes all of the elements. The issue is that the earlier piece of legislation, in addition to mandating electronic records being preserved in electronic form, also required the archivist to certify that the White House electronic record systems were in compliance with law in ways that the former administration said on the record would raise some serious separation of powers issues. And so I leave it to others to comment on the existing form of the bill as it moves forward in the House in that respect. I'm interested in the federal record side and making sure that electronic records are properly preserved.
We have a question from one of the members of the Public Interest Declassification Board, Mr. Brick.
Yes.
Yes.
I'm Herb Brick from the PIDB. This is to Jason, although I'd be interested in Mr. Armstrong's comments on this as well. Jason, at the very conclusion of your last comment there, you made a reference to, I believe it was Fannie Mae and this litigation I was unfamiliar with, and you very quickly stated that at the end of this painful exercise in which they had spent, what was it?
9% of their budget on one search, yeah.
And found six, I believe your figure was 660,000 responsive documents?
Yes, okay. Off of backup tapes, right.
What, okay, in this whole construct here of preservation of email, okay, which I think everyone agrees is a laudable idea, but in the context of what we're talking about here today on FOIA, what now? Okay. What does Fannie? I do not know what size FOIA staff Fannie Mae has. Okay. I don't know how long it takes to review 660,000 documents. I don't know how long it took to determine out of how many millions of records they have that 660,000 were responsive. I don't know how long that's going to delay any other FOIA requests that they have as those documents are being reviewed. This aspect of the problem is not trivial, far from it, and it absolutely must be considered in the context of what we're talking about here. There's an illusion that is created that if we save the documents, we have somehow gotten into the end zone here of addressing the problem. You talked earlier about the needle in the haystack of a billion documents. That is a very real problem. In this situation, and unless that is addressed, this is way beyond the capacity of the government right now to address. Another executive order without immense increase in funding, resources to tackle this problem would be worse than where we are now because it creates unrealistic expectations on the part of the public.
I agree with all that. I have written a law review that's been cited by a number of federal courts called Information Inflation, Can the Legal System Adapt?, which is addressing the issue of what to do with increasing volumes of electronic stuff. And where I come out is that we all have to be smarter. We have to have smarter search strategies than keyword searching. It was something on the order of 400 keywords that were put in to a database to come up with those 660,000 documents. My experience is that it took 6 months to search 200,000 emails using a staff of 25 people at the archives on the tobacco litigation. We can't scale that up. If you have a billion objects, you don't have time on Earth between the time that the Milky Way and the Andromeda galaxies merge to do FOIA. Anymore.
That's a metaphor for you.
So the fact is we have to be smarter. Now, that was not a FOIA case. That was an e-discovery case. I don't think it had impact on the FOIA realm of the Fannie Mae. But you know, there's only so much staff involved totally. We all have to be – it's a wake-up call for all lawyers. In e-discovery, the request to produce documents has the potential of millions and millions of relevant documents being found on backup tapes, on online systems, whatever. And I'm out there as an advocate through the Sedona Conference of being smarter about search strategies. I think every FOIA officer in government should be kind of aware of the e-discovery world that's taking place because it's only a matter of time before they too are affected with the kind of demands that we see routinely in e-discovery for metadata, for all sorts of objects that come up in litigation but may not have hit every FOIA office in the government. So I'm very sympathetic to the comment.
Just an appendix. I don't think it's a problem because under the – I'm not sure in that case we were talking about FOIA materials. There are a lot of litigation reasons to do it. And that's probably where our guidance should come from. Something has to be reasonably described. And it's true that if an unreasonable requester may have identified material that is so voluminous that they just can't get it, that wouldn't be a reasonable request in my view. But reasonable people can, as they do in litigation quite often, sit down and come up with mutually agreeable search terms, metadata terms, confines, and go through a huge maw of data the size you took and come out with a sample, admittedly it may only be a sample, of clearly relevant material that is reviewable by this. One side needs to review it before the other to make sure, and then to expand upon that to get to a reasonable distillate of information that's relevant to the task at hand. You can't ask for everything in a department under the FOIA. You can't ask for everything in a under a particular contractor. You have to have some reasonably refined language that is easier dealt with in an electronic environment than it is in a paper environment, because it doesn't require the same degree of search. Now, I haven't mentioned the classification issues that are there. And as long as classification doesn't include a tear line approach, as long as that doesn't become part of the system, then you're going to have an enormous problem in even determining what is relevant, because only one side is going to look at it, and that's going to take too much of their time. I've gotten out of the declassification business. I'm trying to get into the business of making sure that things don't get classified in the first place, so far as that's possible, or have an automatic deadline for at least the release of a significant portion of it. But with those things in mind, this is not an insurmountable task. I don't know that this galaxy and this Andromeda strain or whatever are emerging. I'm not sure what that means. Is it imminent? But that's this kind of worry that we've heard repeatedly along the lines. This is too big a problem. We can't begin to address it. Well, it's addressed every day. I mean, I've been involved in five cases in the last 2 years that are addressing things that involve hundreds of thousands of documents. It's not that difficult. It's not easy, but it's not that difficult. And as Jason said, for a lot of reasons, you get away from keyword searches. One of them is the inaccessibility of OCRing everything and the inexactness of that. But there's still ways to get to what you want, what you need, and what whether it's a lawsuit or a FOIA request or good public policy, the government wanting to manage its own business, what they ought to need to get the information that they would want.
Well, that's quite optimistic. Max, you have the next question.
Well, and actually, this is actually a good segue to that, because as Dan knows, this morning we had a very interesting discussion about TARP. And I brought up the fact that in the House Oversight Committee last week, Congressman Kucinich had a very nice hearing about, after he got past the outrage about not being able to account for where all the TARP money has gone, the second panel had a very good discussion about potential use of something called XBRL, which is Extensible Business Reporting Markup Language. The SEC, as a matter of policy, already has a pilot program out where they're requiring small corporations of a certain size to deliver their 10K and 10Q filings in marked up language to make it very possible for these things not only to be displayed publicly on websites, but also to be searched in a very logical fashion. And I would suggest to you that there might be room for, or there might be a need for a similar markup language for record keeping, extensible record keeping markup language, or an extensible classification markup language. And it just seems to me like, you know, you've got to make a combination of policy and technology here. The policy to say this is what's going to be done, and a technology that says, yeah, this is what's possible, let's go do it.
That actually is, it's a very valid point. And the basis for NARA's Electronic Records Archive project, which is to ingest all of the types of proprietary records of the government, is to wrap them in XML in a way that makes them authentic records going forward in the future. And so I'm very supportive of that kind of strategy for long-term record keeping and preservation.
I'm a ringer because my sister works for NARA in that project.
NARA needs all the inside help it can get sometimes. So that's good that we have that ringer. I bet you didn't know that you had a NARA person with such a connection to the media. Presumably, that will not impair her career in any respect whatsoever. Question over here. Yes, ma'am.
I was curious about the panel's ideas. We've dealt with the problem of recall versus with the birth of the information at hand as one of the emblematic problems. When someone says that they want to digitally preserve something that's born digital, I immediately worry about packaging. such as my WordPerfect document from my high school classes, would be completely illegible right now. Good luck finding something for that. Even though my C64 games are still available through emulation. What are your thoughts on moving forward as far as something fairly simple like electronic mail is concerned, or just in general about preserving the whole feel of an electronic document?
And not using COBOL, correct?
Right.
I didn't rule out COBOL.
Right. I mean, this is the problem of our age, our migration issues. We can all find 50-year-old pieces of paper in our attic, but we can't deal with floppy disks. Jeff Rothenberg has a quote that digital data it lasts either 5 years or forever, whichever is longer. And the fact is that there's a problem with inaccessible data because of format change. The answer I just gave is NARA's answer going forward for the future, that we're willing to take in a variety of electronic objects across a variety of proprietary structures in government and wrap metadata layers around them in XML so as to preserve the proprietary structure and read that in the future. I think there are strategies for simplifying the amount of proprietary software that the government has, but that's a very difficult task at hand, and it may well be that Mr. Armstrong is more sanguine than I am on the ability of the government to force the marketplace to create a standard set of proprietary software, but it's something that to be looked at in the future.
Speaking of 5 years versus forever, we could go on with this panel forever, I'm sure, but we'll have to make this the final question right here.
Yes, real quick. I just have a question for Mr. Barron.
You need to step a little closer to the mic, I think.
I just have my name is Lois Chichester from Department of State, and I just have a question for Mr. Barron. Do you think the eCPIC data call would help us improve the management of electronic records for all IT systems?
I didn't hear the...
Do you agree that the eCPIC data call for all IT investments that create and maintain federal records will help us improve the preservation of electronic records, considering that it has an effect on appropriations for those IT investments?
I'm not familiar with it, but I'm sure the answer is yes. anything that's out there.
But NARA's Bulletin 2006-02 supports the CIPIC, data call. So I was just saying that sort of, to kind of give a little, I guess, heads up for Mr. Armstrong that we might be improving the preservation of electronic records.
Does that mean that you're, in effect, inviting Mr. Armstrong or anyone else, for that matter, to make more FOIA requests at the State Department?
I wouldn't do that to the Department of State. I'm just saying that we are making a concerted effort to, improve our management and preservation of electronic records.
Let me just warn you, too. Should you be taking any of those snapshots that Jason was speaking of? That would be a static shot of all of your email at one point in time. If FOIA requesters were to ever hear about that, mm-hmm. wouldn't that be the subject? Yeah, had you thought about that? If you take a snapshot and the FOIA requester knows that you have a snapshot and says, here, I'm going to reasonably describe those records. Give me the snapshot you took last Tuesday. Just a thought.
Okay, thanks.
Listen, folks, we're running a little bit over on time. So what I first like to do is thank very much our panelists here for this.